So welcome to our JCC Men's Club. It's great to be back. It's always fun. And I know that during COVID, it is a challenge for us to get out. I love coming by with Mr. Kanner and with your new President Coffer. You like the way that sounds?
Yeah.
President Coffer. You know, that could be a few years down the pike. We may have someone in your family. We don't know. That sounds good. So thank you, everyone, for inviting me back. This is a pre-Hanukkah class, and I call the class Galaxies for Peanuts. So if you saw the ad in the blast, you may have seen Charlie Brown and Snoopy looking up at the universe. Here on your little sheet, you may see little Snoopy on his doghouse looking up. Of course, it's a play on words. Peanuts as in the cartoon versus the literal peanuts. So what I would like to explore with you this morning is the real nature of Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah about? Why do we light? And then at the end of the class, if I accomplish what I hope to accomplish, it's going to give us a prism through which we can see our world, perhaps our universe, in a different way. And I want to dedicate our learning now, our Torah learning, to my wife Rachel's father. Rabbi Klar is a big tzaddik, a very righteous man. He is unfortunately struggling for his life in a New York hospital, not with COVID, with other issues. And so we want to wish again that our learning this morning should be a merit, a zchus, for his refuah shlema, for a complete recovery. His name is Rabbi Harav Chaim Pinchas ben Malka, that he should have refuah shlema in the honor of our learning today. So I'm going to ask you a question. Anyone here, it's not a good movie, but does anyone here remember a movie called Christmas Vacation with Chevy Chase?
Yeah.
I know rabbis are probably not going to see Christmas movies, but there's a very cute scene which you don't have to see the movie to even enjoy. And the scene is Chevy Chase, the lead character, has about 1.5 million Christmas lights strung everywhere around his property. And about half the movie goes by before Chevy can manage to get all the lights working. Apparently, if one light bulb is defective within the string, and he has about 1 million strung together, then apparently all the others are defective. So he spends half the movie trying to change out every light bulb and get it working. And unbeknownst to him, there's a circuit downstairs by the fridge, and when somebody flips the switch, that is the issue at hand. So somebody goes down to get something from the fridge, and they flip the switch, and kaboom, it lights up. Now, when I say it lights up, it's like daylight. His neighbors across the street also, it's like the sun came out. And you see in the hills, a very funny scene, the hills of Hollywood are blacked out from the drain from his house alone. It's a very, very funny scene. So here's my question. And it may sound silly, but I really think that if you travel around the streets of Kingston, I know if you go down First Ave, where I live, you're going to see some very beautiful, very glorious Christmas decoration. I mean, these guys, their power bill, I am sure that at the end of the day, when UGI sends out their bills in January, they're very happy to have customers like this because they're obviously paying a fortune to light up the world. And compare that with our Hanukkah lights. All right, fine. The last night you say we have 8 going and we have a shamash going and maybe we have like an electric one in the window. But by comparison, I think that the lights of the menorah, of the Hanukkah menorah, perhaps get short shrift when compared to our Christian friends and neighbors. So the question is, what is it all about? Why are we lighting? That's the question at hand. Okay, so let's begin with source 1 and 2. And I'm just going to paraphrase for expedience sake. Aaron, Moses' big brother, the first of the priests, the Kohanim, he was upset because all the tribal princes brought inauguration gifts on the day that God's home, called the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was open for business, was inaugurated. And he, as the chief representative of the tribe of Levi, so this would be your great-great-great-grandfather, Harvey, because Harvey is a Kohen. So the Kohanim and Levi'im, the Jewish priests and the Levites, they were excluded from the inauguration specifically because they do the work, right? In God's home, they're the ones who are doing all the sacrificing, and they're the ones lighting the menorah in the temple every day, etc. They weren't allowed to bring gifts. And Aaron felt badly. He wasn't jealous in a negative way. He felt, how come my tribe, and more specifically me and my family, how come we're left out of the equation? So God says to Aaron, your honor, your privilege of lighting the menorah is greater than their one-time gift. So on a simple level, one would say, what is he been told? And judge another Kohen in the building. I'm sorry, I don't mean to leave out my Kohanim this morning. I might get a Kohen rebellion. Anyone else is a Kohen or any other Levites or priests here? Okay, so we have two very distinguished Kohanim, Harvey and Judge. What? Barry is a Levite. Right, exactly. So we're well represented from the tribe of the Levites, of Levi. So what happens? God assures Aaron, don't worry, Aaron. Don't feel aggrieved. Your honor is greater. So on a simple level again, what is the answer to this? Why is the honor of Aaron greater? Because it's forever. Whereas the gifts from the priests, from the princes, the leaders of the tribes, as beautiful as those gifts were, they were a one-time occurrence. But I think it goes beyond that. Because let me ask you a question. How many unique jobs in the temple were reserved for the priests? Many of them bringing sacrifices. How about entering the holiest place in the world, called literally the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKodeshim, on the holiest day of the year called Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Atonement? That's what an honor, right? And only one man, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, Aaron in other words, he's the only individual who ever gets to go into the holiest place ever. How come God doesn't cite that as a sort of a comfort, if you will, for Aaron who's feeling left out? You know why? So the rabbis say it's actually not about the menorah of the tabernacle in the wilderness or the future temple in Jerusalem. It's not about that at all. It is specifically about Hanukkah. And that one day, the Maccabees, who descend from Aaron, from his family, they're going to rise up, they're going to win a great victory, and then they're going to relight the menorah in the temple. That event, the Hanukkah festival, is going to be something that is, for all generations, that is going to be unique, and unique to them and them alone. So now let's look at source number 3. So now that we know a little of the backstory of Hanukkah, that it actually goes back to a promise God made Aaron, I'm going to take it a step further. I want to examine a story. And again, I don't need to use all my sources here. I just did this for you to take home and have homework to do. I was joking. By the way, teachers love on Zoom, in the Zoom world, they love not even teaching anymore. They just dole out homework and say, go home and learn it. So who ends up learning the material? Moi, right? My son comes to me and says, how about that? Can we sit and learn? I said, did you learn it? No, we got a review. I'm like, okay. I didn't realize that I'm being employed as a teacher again. It's great. I'm back in business. So again, this is just for you to sort of peruse through at your whim, but it's not really necessary. So let me paraphrase. So there's a very, very famous story coming up in next week's Torah reading. Not this Shabbat, but the following Shabbat. The story of Joseph and his brothers. More specifically, the famous story when Joseph is the viceroy, the king of Egypt, and the brothers, 10 of them, come down because there's a famine in the promised land of Israel, known as the land of Canaan back then. And they come, they don't recognize the viceroy being Joseph. He, of course, recognizes them. And he puts them through a lot of ups and downs, shall we say, a lot of travails. So it's a very famous story. It's so famous that Donny Osmond, right, played Joseph, the Technicolor Dreamcoat movie, right? They even made it on Broadway. Big story. So what happens in the story? The brothers come and they appear before Joseph. And if you look at story number 3, they're worried because Joseph has accused them of being spies. Okay, and what happens when they come back to Israel to bring little brother Benjamin to validate the fact that, no, they're not spies. Indeed, they are members of one big happy family, and they're going to bring little baby brother, who's 30 years old, Binyamin. Benjamin is going to be the proof that the words that they speak before this paranoid, delusional king, who they don't know is Joseph, that their words are true. Okay? So on their way back, they leave, and Joseph commands his servants, take all the money that the brothers paid for the food that they purchased here, because remember, it was a famine back in Israel, and he said, take their money and bury it in their sacks. So on their way back, one of the brothers, actually Levi, discovers the money in his sack. And then when they get back to Israel itself, all the brothers realize every penny has been returned. And they are crestfallen. Why? Because they believe that this maniacal Egyptian is setting them up. When they will next come back to Egypt, what is he going to say to them? Not only are you guys spies, you're also robbers. You're gnaven. You're thieves. You stole my money. What's going on? And it's going to be a pretense to accuse them and to lock them up. Okay, so what happens? Jacob refuses to let Benjamin go, and they wait a little while for their newly replenished food stocks to diminish. And then the king of the brothers, the future king, Judah, Yehuda, the king of the brothers, steps up, and he says, Dad, he says to Jacob, look, I know you don't want to let Benjamin go. I understand. Benjamin is the last piece of Rachel that exists in this world. Joseph, we don't know where he is. Could be he's alive, could be he's dead. Even the brothers, of course, at that point, don't know what happened to Joseph. They just know that they sold him. They don't know what the final outcome is. And, of course, Rachel died prematurely at age 36. So the only certain part of Rachel that exists in this world is little Benjamin. And so Jacob's reluctant to let him go with these guys. He doesn't trust the brothers. Judah said, I want to tell you, Dad, it's all on me. He steps up very famously and says, I guarantee the safety of the lad. If I don't bring him back well, untouched, then I lose my world now, and I even lose my world to come, heaven. I give it all up if I can't bring Benjamin back untouched and unharmed. Okay? So reluctantly, Jacob acquiesces and says, fine. I obviously don't have a choice, because if I say no, you won't go and we're all going to starve. So this is the only sort of like a Hail Moshe pass that maybe, right, we're going to get through this in a positive way. So what does Jacob do? And again, you'll see this inside the reading, but it's very interesting. He takes out a little bit of a gift. He says, look, if you got to go, don't go empty-handed. You don't want to be like the ungrateful guest who came for dinner. Bring the king a gift. Something special from the land of Israel. Now remember, it's a famine. So what do they have to offer the king? So he says, take some pistachios and some almonds and some spices. Things that I grew myself, Jacob said, that we have here. We don't have a lot, but we'll make a nice little mincha. We'll give him a little gift. Some peanuts. I understand peanuts didn't exist back then, but you have to give me a little room here. Bring him some peanuts. That'll work. So the brothers are probably thinking to themselves, So this crazy king accuses us of being spies. Won't take no for an answer. We have to bring Benjamin back. Money is returned, tons of money, millions of dollars of money that we spend has just been thrown back in our faces. And Dad, you think that giving him a little bit of pistachios and peanuts, that's really the way forward? But of course, he's their father, he's Jacob, he's Yaakov. So even if they don't understand his logic, they go along with it. Okay, what happens? They get back to Egypt. It's a great story, right? This is a reason alone to come to synagogue, to come to temple, just to get through these stories. They're the best. So what happens? Jacob stays home, and the brothers bring Benjamin down. And they are nervous. They're on shpilkas, right? As they say in Yiddish. They don't know what's going to be. So they show up at the gate at the border crossing. The TSA agents are there, and immediately they check him in, and they bring them to the man in charge of Joseph's house. And the man is about to talk to the brothers, and then the brothers step up and say, "Oh my gosh, you won't believe it. We took all our food that we purchased when we were here last, and we opened up our sacks, each man his own sack. Guess what was there hiding? All the money. Every shekel of money that we paid for our original supplies that we bought. And we brought it back with us, and not only that, because of inflation, we brought back double the money to show that we are honest, upstanding citizens. We are not thieves." Whew! And it's like a whole outpouring of their worries. And you can see the outpouring in number five. And you read through it. It's almost like in one breath. And then, you know what? The man in charge of Joseph's house, who's actually Joseph's son, Manasseh, you know what he says to the men, to the brothers, his uncles, in other words, unbeknownst to them? He says, "It's okay. We got the money. God must have given you a secret present that you found in your sacks. Because it says here on our ledger, we have a really good bookkeeper here, that every penny that you paid was accounted for and received. So whatever you found in your sacks, there was nothing nefarious about that. Your God must have given you a gift." So the brothers are, of course, blown away by this. They don't understand which way is up, which way is down. And then, of course, the next natural thing happens. You're going to have lunch at the White House with the viceroy. And, of course, this makes entire sense, right? You go from being accused criminals, spies, and then you're going to dine with the president in the White House at lunch. Like, this is a reasonable thing. So the four brothers are, to say the least, discombobulated by the whole affair. And then what do? It says they take out the present, the peanuts, the popcorn, the almonds, the pistachios, the botni mushkedim, and they take the little present that they had mentally belittled when their dad Jacob said, "Bring this little present," and they start to sort of put it together and make it look nice and presentable because they're going to lunch with the king. Oh my gosh. So what happened? What just happened? Before I answer the question, rabbis like to do this. Can you all hold on to this information at this moment? Before I give you the real answer, I want to ask a question about a very curious earlier story. You ready? Here's the earlier story. And you all know the story because we just read it in this past Parsha Vayishlach. Jacob has WrestleMania 1. Remember the famous story? Jacob, it says, is confronted by the protector angel of his dear twin brother Esau. And the angel comes down from heaven to confront and to vanquish Jacob once and for all. The evening before the fateful meeting after 20 years where Jacob and Esau are going to meet up again. Because remember, Jacob, when last being in Israel, what happened? He dressed up like his brother. He deceived Isaac into giving him the blessings. And then mom and dad said, "You better run away, get a family, and make sure the wrath of Esau will slowly over the generation perhaps dissipate. Go away." So he's just been 20 years in exile in dear wicked Uncle Laban's home. He comes back. He has a beautiful family, 11 beautiful sons, Benjamin on the way. And then it says he divides his camp up into two camps to prepare for the potential for war, that maybe Esau's coming with the 400 men that he hears in the reports on Twitter and on Facebook, and he doesn't know the intent of Esau. Perhaps Esau doesn't know the intent of Esau. So he prepares to meet Esau by preparing for war. He sends Esau gifts, and he prays to God for help. And that night, he separates himself from the family, it says, and he crosses back over a little stream called Yabok. You know why he went? Because he forgot on the original crossing during the daylight hours when he was taking his family across and the valuables, he forgot some little knickknacks, some little trinkets on the other side. And because he values them, even though objectively perhaps they're valueless, they're not going to fetch a big price on eBay, But to Jacob, they're meaningful enough that he endangers himself, very strangely, by making himself vulnerable. And what happens when he goes across the river? The angel comes, they wrestle all night long, and he wins. He gets injured, right? The sciatic nerve is damaged. That's why you can't have the delicious porterhouse steaks and the sirloins that we as Jews don't eat because of the sciatic nerve that runs in the middle of the sirloin area of the cow, sadly. But he gets a new name. The angel gives him the name Israel, Yisrael, right? He wins in battle the moniker of Israel. So here's the question. And this question is going to answer what Jacob later understood about the maniacal Egyptian leader and why he would send him this weird little gift of some peanuts and popcorn and stuff, which doesn't seem to have any value at all. Oh, it has no value. The stuff that he went back for, Jacob did, when he got almost killed by the angel, what did we say was the value of the stuff he forgot? Like nothing. Just stuff. Collectibles. Do you see a common thread here? So maybe if we can understand the urgency that Jacob felt to retrieve these little objects, these little knickknacks, maybe we will understand later how Jacob's able to conceptualize how to play with the king of Egypt and what he really was after. So what was Jacob's, what was his motivation? Why would he place himself in danger? Listen to this. Beautiful. What matters in life? Is it your stock portfolio? No. I've never read an obituary yet. Doesn't mean they don't exist. Where it says, you know, Mr. Goldfarb, by the way, the reason I use Goldfarb and Shulbaum is if we had a prominent family named Goldfarb and Shulbaum, I wouldn't use them in my stories. Okay, so if you know anyone, it's not personal. So it doesn't say, here lies, you know, Seymour Goldfarb, who acquired a wonderful stock portfolio, including Zoom and Apple. And, you know, he had season tickets to the courtside seats to the New York Knicks. He used to sit right next to Spike Lee. They don't usually say things like that in an obituary. What do they talk about? They obviously talk about the life of the individual, his family, his profession, his accomplishments, the organizations that he perhaps volunteered for or was involved with, and even more, some of the personal highlights of what made this individual shine. What made this individual the individual? These are the things that we talk about in an obituary, right? Has anyone, God forbid, ever had to go through a house after someone we love passed away? I had to do that when my father passed away. So when you're in the house, you're looking at little things that are your dad's, your mom's. You're not going to want to throw away any of that stuff. But it's not the big things, right? It's not the china and the silverware. Okay, that's nice also. But the little knickknacks, the little personal items that defined the essence of who dad or mom was, who they were, how they lived, the first dollar they made, some little league award or something maybe they got in baseball that's a little, you know, tchotchke worth 50 cents. You know what? To you and to me, it's priceless. Priceless. Even MasterCard can't go there. It's worth the world. These were the items that Tzaddik, the righteous individual Jacob, valued. This is why he went back to get them. In other words, the big ticket items he brought across with the family. But then he realized, oh my gosh, there's some little things that are me, that are Jacob. His investment in the world was waiting on the other side of that stream. Hence, he goes back, even to sort of risk and expose himself to an attack, which actually happened, correct? This is what defines the person, the investment we make in this world. Okay, let's fast forward now to that original question. The brothers don't understand. How come dad saw something in the behavior of this maniacal king, meaning Joseph, that we never saw coming? In other words, the money's been returned. What is significant? Is it an excuse for us to become slaves? So Jacob already sees the big picture because he's really smart. There's a reason you become a patriarch of the Jewish people. What did Jacob see? Look, he sees in his own mind again. Let's patrol the mind of Jacob, of Yaakov Avinu. What does Jacob understand? If the king of Egypt wanted you there, you wouldn't be here. He doesn't need to come up with a ruse to accuse you of being thieves and let you go. If he wanted you there, you'd be rotting in jail right now. Oh, so then what does the king want? Does he want money? Does he want you to show him respect by writing a nice check out? No, of course not. What is he doing with your money? He's throwing it back at you. He's saying, I don't want your stupid money. Take it. Oh my gosh, so he doesn't want your money. What does he want? So this is the same issue that Jacob understands from going back over that little stream to Parshas earlier in his life. You know what the Egyptian king wants? He wants honor. He wants you to honor him, show him respect. The Rodney Dangerfield thing that's lacking. He wants you to recognize him. So, it's not the value of the gift that he wants. What does he want from you? You. Something personal. Jacob growing peanuts and pistachios. That you invest the time to have a little pistachio peanut garden. This is the type of thing that the king wants. Because it's you. It's a personal gift. Oh my gosh. So the brothers don't pick up on this. They're oblivious. Jacob gets the whole thing, and he's right on. Okay, let me ask you a question. What if the king in the story with the brothers and Joseph, what if the king is not the king? What if God is the king? Because he is. He's the king of kings. The Melech Malchei HaMelechim. And what if the question at hand is what Jacob, Israel, meaning us, the Jewish people, should give to the king? I asked the question at the outset. Our Christian neighbors like Chevy Chase do a whole lot better job of lighting up this world for their Christmas holiday than we do with our eight little lights or less our first night, right? One light, like Rabbi Hillel. So one light in a menorah compared to the gazillion lights. I know that's not a word, but it sounds like it could be a word. The gazillion lights that are lit up. So what is more meaningful to God? Let me ask a question. Let's pretend for a moment, let's use the analogy, Joseph, king of the world, God, king of the universe. Does money have any value to the king of the world? Of course not. It's so valueless, it's a joke, right? He's just throwing it back. Does light have any value to God? Well, not the way we think about it. Do you all know what a quasar is? I research this. I'm not an expert, but let me share with you. A quasar is the greatest light source in the history of our universe. It is essentially that star that goes into black hole mode, and right before it does, it becomes a quasar, not just a watch company. And a quasar, and you'll look this up, it's again theoretical because we're not in such proximity to the closest quasar. But in one light second of a quasar's existence, it is the most luminous thing ever in the history of our universe. I would dare say that if you took all the light of every Christmas light, menorah, Kwanzaa, Festivus, if you're Seinfeld fans, any other holiday that we light lights, take all the light together and compare it with 1 second of a quasar's light that it emits. Who do you think wins? Of course the quasar wins. It's a joke. Well, if God created quasars and billions of stars that are much more luminous than our own sun, it's not the quantity of light that he's after. What is he after? He's after the fact that you light. It's the quality of the light, of course. It's personal. So in other words, we as Jewish people understand we don't string gazillions of lights up because that's not the purpose of Hanukkah. God says, you know what the king wants? Me? I want you to light for me. And if you care enough And if you invest in this world to become sensitive enough to light a menorah in Hanukkah, I don't care that it's one little light or eight little lights. The fact that you light is why I love you. And this is the promise to Aaron. When Aaron originally was aggrieved, it wasn't just about that he gets the light, a menorah in the temple, or the Jews would light later. It was a lesson that the greatest gift we can give to God is the light of the menorah, but not in a conventional way. It's the fact that we give him the gift of our heart, that we care. Let me end with something mind-bending. Again, this is more Kabbalistic, so take it for what it is. Remember we talked about Jacob going back across that little stream because he forgot some little knickknacks. You want to know what the mystical Kabbalah says about that? One of the knickknacks that he went back for was a very anonymous little earthenware piece. Guess what happened to that earthenware piece? We know exactly what happened to it. You ready? It was the Pach Shemen, that little earthenware jug, unbroken and undefiled, that the Maccabees found in the Hanukkah story to relight the menorah. That little flask was brought back across the stream, forgotten originally by Jacob. That was the source of the light of Hanukkah, that he cared to go back for that. Now, whether you take it in a literal way, or the rabbis are simply saying that the mindset of Jacob retrieving these articles is tantamount to that jug, it doesn't necessarily have to be a literal truth. You might say, Rabbi, come on, how could that jug survive, you know, the slavery in Egypt and the sojourn in the... I don't know. It's irrelevant. The bottom line is, Hanukkah and the miracle of the light is sourced literally in Jacob going back across that little stream. So it's galaxies for peanuts. Now you understand why I called it the name I did. God has galaxies. What do they mean to him? Not a whole lot, because they're a dime a dozen. Stars and quasars, they're generic. They're a dime a dozen. But that a Jew cares enough for 8 nights of Hanukkah to get out that menorah and light that menorah, priceless in the realm of God. We should all be zocha, we should all merit this Hanukkah when our world needs light more than ever. The darkness of COVID right after Purim that has enveloped our world. We really need light back. And I think that if we start with ourselves to invest to light up the world. Doesn't take a whole lot. Remember, you can have a huge vacuous room, black, and one Hanukkah light will destroy and vanquish the darkness from that room. We should all merit to become what God wants us to become, the Or Lagoyim, the light unto the nations, the light unto our world. Thank you.